Hello, and thanks for choosing this Analyst Insight podcast from the Information Security Forum. Thanks for your continued support. We're building up quite a sizable audience for these podcasts, which suggests we're doing something right. And we've got plans to experiment with formats this year, so do stay tuned to lots of new things to tempt you with. This episode is one of those newer formats, and in this one, we'll be chewing over an incident or breach at an organization, not necessarily an ISF member. In fact, I hope it isn't. Exploring what happened, seeing how they coped, and what can be learned from that event. It's a bit of InfoSec Schadenfreude, but no less useful for that. My name is Mark Ward. I'm a senior research analyst at the ISF, and I've regularly covered breaches as a journalist, not really lived through one, I don't think. And definitely the character of those breaches changed a lot during my career. Went from the curious amateur stage, sort of the hackers just messing about, to those organized crime groups hitting organizations later on. And a big breach made up for a very busy day. WannaCry, very busy day for me, but not possibly not as busy as for those folks who had to cope with its impact. But anyway, we've got a much more experienced panel than me to analyze the incident and response today. First up is Paul Watts, a regular on the podcast, who has the thousand-yard stare of someone who's dealt with a few breaches. Am I right, Paul? Have you been there, seen there? Have you got a T-shirt?
Well, I am wearing a T-shirt because you told me last time that coming topless on podcast recordings was not acceptable. So I have come dressed for the occasion.
Put me off my dinner.
Look, do you know what? I've dealt with everything from minor events to major crisis. I've dealt with threat actors ranging from individuals to collusional insiders to organised gangs of external attackers. I've seen them opportunistic attacks. I've seen researched and highly targeted. I've seen simple naivety, acts of gross stupidity, serious matters that impact our national security. And no, I can't talk about those. And, you talk about the way that we react to these. Some of these events just make me sit back and laugh. Some make me really angry, really frustrated. And others, and, serious happen for a minute, they damage my health short term, damage the health of my team and beyond. And with that in mind, you talk about Schadenfreude, but I am always sympathetic to those who have to deal with these similar situations. This may well be what we've trained for, to coin a phrase, but people process this in very, very different ways, and coping with it can be a challenge. And you get some curveballs as well, Mark. So I had one. There was an incident, and it started as a typical investigation into employee productivity, and I ended up in the middle of a child exploitation case, giving evidence as a professional witness in a criminal trial. So a bit of a mixed bag. But as I'm sure we're going to talk about, if you put all of these incidents and breaches that I've dealt with side by side, there are common threads that you can pull on. And I guess that's what we're going to talk about today, Mark.
Indeed. Yep. Keep your hands on those threads. But also here is Esther Schagen van Luyt, former CISO at Deloitte Netherlands, who I would imagine knows a way around this territory. Have you been there, seen that, done some breaches?
Yes. So right now I'm in principle with ISF, but indeed as a former CISO and also a former cybersecurity consultant, I see my fair share of breaches both from a responder and a supporting perspective. And I always find it's very interesting cyber incident response. I really admire the resilience that it evokes in people that are dealing with such events. So from that perspective, I'm very much looking forward to today's conversation as well.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, certainly the reason we're doing this podcast is because the British Library released a report into how they handled it and what happened. Yeah, and I think that's what comes through in there. They do mention the sort of effect on staff and morale and things like that.
I do have to pull you up on something there, Mark, because you said to Esther, have you done some breaches? I'd like to think that Esther has been the one responding side of those, rather than... Is it something about you we don't know?
It was that phishing email I clicked on this morning. That'll be fine.
Absolutely. Yeah. And she's got such a trusting face as well.
Definitely. And also, for the first time, we have Alex Jordan, Head of Security Tools and Methodologies at the ISF. Hello, Alex.
Hi, Mark. Thanks very much for having me. Pleasure to be here. Podcast newbie, but suffice to say, I've been listening to plenty of them on my morning dog walks over the past year or so. So excited to try and get stuck into this a little bit and sort of figure out what went right, what didn't go so well. And we're going to talk about this a lot, but there's a lot to chew over.
Yeah, it's quite a significant report and, very significant incident as well. But also, quite a lot of people seem to listen to the podcast while walking their dogs. I want pictures of these dogs. So if you're out there, lovely listeners, send us pictures of your dogs. We will share them. That would be awesome.
I will start a WhatsApp group. I love WhatsApp groups of dog pictures.
Absolutely.
I haven't got a dog.
I do have a dog and I do listen to this podcast while walking him.
Yeah, I don't have a dog, but I walk a dog for someone else. I do listen to the podcast while I'm walking him. Hello, Monty.
Paul, you and I live close enough together. You can come walk the dog with me. We listen to the podcast together.
Do you know what? Yeah, get one of those big ghetto blasters used to walk around with in the 80s. It's like, we're going. Today's podcast is all about breeches. Does Esther Dunn breeches?
I'm with Paul here. Advertise the podcast to everyone. That'd be
absolutely
great.
Absolutely.
Definitely. Yeah. Let's take it public. Cool. Right. So just quickly summarise what happened at the British Library. The attack took place 28th of October last year and compromised most of the British Library's online systems. Sort of 7:30 in the morning on that day, it was identified because some internal IT staff couldn't log into their emails. And it turned out everybody was locked out of pretty much every system. Just reading how they quickly responded, it sounds like they acted pretty quickly. They invoked their crisis management plan, had the Gold Crisis Response Team notified and convened by 10 a.m. that morning, so just a couple of hours later. But they had to use WhatsApp to communicate because email was not available. They brought in the NCSE to help, and then an external security firm was engaged as well. The bad guys took 600 gigabytes of files. They also destroyed servers to prevent any kind of quick recovery. As you might expect with a library, they do have good backups for most of the materials in the library, the books and digital copies and things like that. But the rest of it, maybe not quite so much. And certainly what emerges in that report is just how bit of a mess the internals of the British Library were. There's a lot of legacy systems there, and I think the report says that was one of what let them down. It was a terminal services server that looks like a brute force attack on a privileged account that came through that. There was no MFA on it, though it was noted as a risk recently, just before the event. And ironically, they had a plan in place that was due to roll out in 2024 to improve the security around those systems because they'd expanded greatly during the pandemic, as in many other organizations. So, yeah, I mean, that's a very quick overview, and we'll dig into some more of the details as we chat about this. But I don't know, Paul, Esther, Alex, it sounds like a pretty standard organization, I guess. I mean, its estate was a bit old, but it was it's modernizing. It had cloud services. I don't know, from the outside, as a not a professional, it looks pretty standard, but I don't know, were there any things that stood out for you guys?
Not really. Pretty standard MO. I sound quite flippant when I say that, but all the traditional hallmarks of an attack were there and laid bare.
From my perspective, I think, yes, I would mostly agree with Paul on that. I think the only thing I would sort of maybe call out to your point of legacy systems and what have you, Mark, from what I gather from this, they do have a lot of very old systems that have been merged together from a lot of sort of acts of parliament and things like that, where there being sort of consolidation of different bodies together to form what is now the British Library. And I think a lot of the technologies that they've got there, some of them will be very archaic in nature. You're talking operational technology that's designed to sort of pull in bits off of books that haven't been updated in 50 years. So they talk a lot through here about their need to redo their technology infrastructure as a result of this because it's all so antiquated.
I think the issue with technical debt is something that comes up again and again and again. And, the conversations about a decision, rightly or wrongly, that is made to drive a system and infrastructure beyond the end of its supportable and or useful life. Even when you get to a point where you want to modernize your architecture and your infrastructure, you may find that you do not have an upgrade path. I think that was the case in a couple of examples here where you do reach that point of no return and you're not talking about an upgrade, then you're talking about a regeneration. There is something to be said about that slow and steady maintenance of your infrastructure to keep it in that useful zone, rather than letting things go beyond. But as I say, a lot of mergers of collections and lots of reasons. I mean, the ISF's paper on mergers and acquisitions does spell out some of the challenges that we have as organisations when you bring disparate organisations together and don't think about these things. It does come back to haunt you, has the potential to do so.
And I think what featured in the paper as well was, so on the one hand, we had the legacy systems. And then on the other hand, there was mention of not sufficient IT staff, not sufficient cybersecurity staff. And in the back of your mind, you go like, okay, so this is a public institution. They might not have as many funds as large corporations, might not have a professional and big IT team as these corporations. But then thinking back on the CISOs that we've been and the CISOs that we know, I think in the depth of our heart, we know that all of us have legacy systems that are still around that we wouldn't be super comfortable with. And how often you hear as a CISO things like, oh, we want to wait with replacing that core system until next year. Well, that is some of the dynamic that is at play at every large organization, but it's often at the basis of some of these incidents.
Yeah, I think certainly as it's a public institution, I guess it didn't have a huge amount of money to spend and regularly had to make some tough decisions. But it did strike me that they were, again, maybe because it's a public institution, they were pretty diligent and they had done risk assessments on a lot of things and said, yeah, there's a risk there, but we didn't quite appreciate what damage could be done as a result of getting in through these systems. So yeah, I think you're right. It's that if we had more people and more time and more money, sure, we could do more. But I guess they thought they were, as a lot of organizations are, not complacent, I suppose, but thought they were as safe as they could get at that point. I don't know, Paul, have you been in that kind of situation? Just you were waiting for the other shoe to drop. You kind of think, yeah, we're getting away with it a bit here. Or is that the kind of, not quite seat of the pants, but is that sort of a common feeling for CISOs?
I mean, the kicker here is they recognize the need to invest in their infrastructure, and those plans were already in flight. As I said right at the top of the podcast, I do sympathize. They were making all the right noises. They were having all the right conversations. It sounds like they were, lots of proactive stuff was happening in the background. They were pen testing, vulnerability scanning. But you put all these things together, then eventually it's always a matter of when, not if. And that's the reality that we face into now. So it can sometimes be a gamble. What do I need to do it? In what order do I need to do it? You're right. The public sector is always very constrained in terms of what it can invest and when it can invest it. Sounds like they were having all those right conversations. And unfortunately, their luck ran out, which is real shame.
I did wonder about that. I don't know, Alex, were they just unlucky? Because it struck me as, why would the bad guys target someone like the British Library? They ain't got a lot of money, though they did ask for a ransom, which the library didn't pay.
That's a really tricky one to answer. Were they lucky? Were they unlucky? I agree with what Paul is saying in that they were making all the right noises. I mean, even to go back what Esther was saying about with the technology department there, they comment that they appreciated they were overstretched and they were actually beginning to address that in that process. So they knew that there were a degree of weakness, but they were making all the right noises. They were doing the right things. They were previously accredited to Cyber Essentials. And I think just because of the change in Cyber Essentials Plus, that accreditation lapsed. I honestly, in reading this, there is a little sense of there's another breach, but I do have a lot of sympathy in this situation because it's a public institution. They're not able to necessarily do all the things they want to do. It looks like they've tried to do their absolute darndest to sort this out, and yet someone still made it through. And you go and you look, they reckon potentially third-party compromise somewhere. It wasn't even necessarily them precisely. It was someone else, and they just got unlucky. So
I think the standout thing with this is...
It's tricky.
I don't think there was anything to indicate that this was a targeted attack. And, this is important. Conversations you have in the boardroom where they say, well, it's never going to happen to us. Look at us. Why are we important? A lot of these attacks start through opportunistic vectors, scanning, recent vulnerabilities or, working with IAB, initial access brokers, buying credentials, seeing what keys unlock what doors. And then taking a step further, we don't entirely know the events leading up to the initial point of access, apart from the fact that credentials were involved and it was a single factor of authentication that gained initial access. Reconnaissance happened 3 days before the attack, all the traditional hallmarks. But they could have been unlucky from the point that it was an opportunistic attack. They stumbled across a vulnerable server and decided to see where the rabbit hole went, bought a cred, fished somebody, socially engineered somebody. It sounds like we will never know. The reality is, though, they're in and they're in, and they know where it started and they know what happened next. The question is, do you learn from that? And if you look at the back of the report that they published, I find no fault in any of the lessons that they've cited. The thing I would say to kind of wrap all of them together is, a lot of it is just down to getting the basics right. If I had a pound for every time I've said, just get the basics right. There's no point in spending a fortune on swanky technology if you don't know where your crown jewels are and you haven't got a handle on identity and access management. and so on and so forth. So,
yeah, I don't know. Esther, is that, I guess, if you have been dealing with breaches and things like that, and you say, yeah, we were unlucky, that's not, it's not going to get you very far, I guess, in your organization. I mean, I guess you have to try to be lucky as long as possible.
Yeah, and I agree they were unlucky. I mean, it's like Paul said, you should never assume they aren't going to come for you because you're not important enough. I do think in this case, had the report reads very clearly. It's a great report. It's highly structured, transparent, easy to read. It should honestly be a best practice to publish reports like this so we can all learn from breaches. But what stood out to me as well is there is a very factual tone. It's reporting on what has happened and what they've done, which is great. But what I missed a bit, considering that this was the British Library, and I saw that the Financial Times coined a phrase that says, the British Library cyber breach was an attack on the world's knowledge. I miss a little bit of the emotional and moral reflection on this attack, considering these are criminals, based on the policy on public institutions in the UK. They weren't going to pay. So what are you doing here as criminals, trashing a public library and leaving it in destruction as well?
Tatters. Yeah, because curiously, the Rhysider Group, which is the one that did this, named after an African, large African centipede, lovely, said that they were quite, they said they were socially minded, that they did this to expose, to help organisations in the same way that, you know, if a burglar breaks in, they've helped you find your security problems in your own house. And I just, yeah, don't buy it because it was so destructive. And that was what helped hamper the investigation. It was hard to get data out of it.
Do you know what? I get so tired of threat actors, you know, coining this line that, yeah, it's a victimless crime. We're just going after corporates. We're socially minded. We're not this. I mean, I was about to swear then and I won't, but I didn't have all it. You know, there is no such thing as a victimless crime in this context as well. The problem is that the consequences, the unintended and intended consequences, are much further reaching than the initial epicenter of an attack. Yeah. You know, so the library's infrastructure was damaged. And as you say, an attack on knowledge, you know, that's a very powerful statement to make. And then think about all the people who rely on that knowledge. And it's that blast radius that they don't think about when they're after a quick mark. They're just not interested in that at all. I think what's also interesting, we should talk a little bit about this, is we've kind of moved past the point of getting in, bulldozing the estate and holding your hand out for a ransom. Data theft and data exfiltration, and we talked about this a lot, Mark, in Threat Horizon 2024, that we would see ransomware almost evolve and the data, you know, became the asset again, and it was, you know, used for extortion and, you know, third party, you know,
yeah, that triple extortion, wasn't it? Yeah, sort of not just you, but the data and then your customers' data as well. So it's, you know, trying to get you all ways around.
Scientific in the way they went after this data as well. So once they realized what they were looking at, it wasn't a trolley dash like you used to see in the old days there, I call it that, where they would just grab everything and anything and exfil it out.
Supermarkets
with a little bit more science around this. You know, they were looking for very specific assets of high value. And took them out. And something that I, you know, is mentioned in the report, and I've come across this, you know, in conversations with our members and conversations with my peers, is half the battle post-breach when you move into a recovery phase is thinking about the regulatory fallout. Of course, they did all the right things with the ICO and kudos to them. But you then got to go through that painful process of identifying what was touched and what was tampered with and what was stolen. And if you don't have a good handle on your information governance, if you don't know where your crown jewels are or what they are or why they're important, that, let me tell you, is a protracted, time-consuming, painful and expensive job. Expensive job.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that, Alex, sort of from a, I don't, it might have been hard to get a sort of view of this from the report, but did you get a sense that they were well organized, their governance was in place and they were doing the right, it looked like they were doing the right kinds of things.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. I mean, just touching back on what Paul was talking about a little bit in terms of the forensics and looking at what data's gone, what's been touched, they're still doing that now.
Yeah.
It's somewhere in the report, I can't remember precisely, but it's somewhere in Q2 of this year they're looking to finish.
Mid-April. Yeah.
So we're talking 4 to 6 months post-breach before they've even finished trawling through the 600 gigabytes worth of data that's been taken, just to figure out what's gone wrong. But to the governance points, though, I think by the looks of things, and again, this is by the looks of things, I do not have insider knowledge at the British Library, although if there is anyone from the British Library listening to this who'd like to talk, would be delighted in understanding.
I mean,
very deadly seriously. If you ever want to talk, be happy to.
Buy them a copy, at least.
Yeah. But if you look at the way that they structured their sort of initial response, it seems like they followed a pretty well-rehearsed response plan that seems to have pretty good governance processes in place. There is one thing in here which is pretty sort of, they call it out at the end of the report as well, which is they were very well prepared with the exception of we don't have a security team on retainer. So they had to green light a security team in, I think it was 4 hours, and they had to bite the bullet on that cost. They had to get that team in as soon as was physically possible. They didn't have the phone ready to pick up and ring to someone. So I think their internal governance was solid. But the reality is when you are going to a professional services firm at the last minute and asking them to drop whatever else they're on, that's a difficult conversation, and it's not an inexpensive conversation.
It comes down to the, oh yes, it was a lesson learned. I was just kind of scanning back through. No, you're absolutely right. And actually, again, with the sympathy hat on, you know, I often talk about, and Esther will relate, you know, the challenges of security leaders, especially in very, very small teams where you have to be multi-purpose. You're kind of the Swiss Army knife. I noted in the report at T-minus 3 days, the IT security manager, as they were labeled in the report, you know, being called at 10 past one to say something suspicious is happening on the network. I hope that wasn't a, you know, an occurrence that happens often, because if you're the IT security manager getting phoned up at 1 a.m. on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Friday, Saturday, A, you become desensitized to when it's really important. B, even superheroes need to sleep, and it's just not sustainable. So that in its own right is a, you know, a call to action in that, you know, they need to have that breadth. And these things get spotted during cyber simulation exercises, by the way. You know, it's a great way to kind of call that out, just to see where those potential weaknesses are in you know, the golden hour response, and whether you would do anything different if you had your time again. And you know, obviously we've done a lot of these with our members, and you know, that is something that's stand out. So if you can mobilize very, very quickly in the first hour, you've got a good opportunity to limit that blast radius and have a little bit of containment in place and limit the damage. You know, if you're spending hours and hours and hours trying to constitute a team, that's time, valuable time that you're potentially losing in an incident response. So
yeah, I don't know, Esther, from your point of view, looking at the report, did it look like a pretty solid organization? I mean, it sounded like, apart from some of those resource problems.
Really, Mark, from the British Library, from a public institution, it sounded very structured and quite quick. I did read the 1:15 in the morning, and I was like, well, that's one dapper IT security manager there. Because often initially, when you get an alert from the system, you are still in triaging phase. You don't know whether it's really bad or just a little bit bad. So to be getting a call in the middle of the night and then somebody going and running a vulnerability scan around that, I was like, well, they're really on top of things. I'm not sure that would go in the same way across many large organizations in the world. So kudos to the British Library for doing that. But of course, in terms of well-being and ensuring people are able to effectively respond to incidents over a longer period of time with their full sanity, that's not something that should be happening often.
No, it's true. But let's move on now to sort of less of the incident, more of the response, I suppose, and the long-term response, because I was struck by a couple of lines in the report, which it said that their plan to remake their infrastructure pretty much as to make it more secure and, you know, retire a lot of that legacy stuff that simply can't be updated because it's just so the manufacturers of it don't exist anymore, or, you know, just it can't be updated to have those security systems wrapped around it. It said implementation of this plan will require significant changes to our applications, our culture, our ways of working, our policies and processes. So pretty much everything. But again, is that standard, Esther, Paul?
Root cause analysis on what went wrong, of course, but I always feel even if the root cause was a technical miss, you should really be having a much broader view than that, because it's not just often a technical gap, it's processes or people not performing up to a certain standard that enable all of that to take place. So I think it's very good to do a holistic review of what happened.
Paul, you're nodding your head there. Yeah, does that sound like sort of standard practice kind of thing?
I completely look. there's a lot of navel gazing you can do post-breach. What you need to do is take a bit of a deep breath and take a pragmatic view of that. At the end of the day, organisationally, structurally, nothing has really changed, but you have been burned. You don't want to feel that again, but you've still got to take a pragmatic approach to what your remediation looks like. You can't change everything at the same time. I mean, I have this conversation with members and peers when we talk about zero trust, for example. Zero trust isn't something that you can do as a sticking plaster to remediate post-breach. The zero trust is a complicated spider's web of people, process, and technology that interweaves together. And if you don't have the fundamentals right, the basics right, then zero trust isn't going to serve any real purpose at all. So you've kind of got to stratify this and look at the program of remedial work in a pragmatic and structural way. The other thing that they say is the importance of maintaining a holistic view of cyber risk. I think what's important is making sure that cyber risk is shared with the business decision makers who make the decision to accept, treat, or transfer. That is very important because that can also help in terms of prioritization of what needs to be done and in what order it needs to be done. But again, you know, it sounds like all credit that this journey was already starting. I think some of the tin that they procured to rebuild was already procured pre-incident. You know, they were already raking the right noises. And their XDR capability at endpoint was able to deflect most of the characteristic attempts as part of the profile of the attack itself. It was the server estate, which, as we've already talked about, that was in need of work and redress and maintenance and renovation was where the weaknesses are. The problem with defense in depth is if you have a credential breach of privilege and you don't have a segregated network, once the threat actor is in, lateral movement, reconnaissance, and aggregation of privilege is actually very, very straightforward. And then when you detonate, you know, the irony of it is that blast encapsulated their data centers and actually left the endpoints reasonably intact because it was able to deflect. You know, and that just kind of comes back to my point that you've just got to think about the pragmatic order in which you do things as part of a remediation. It's always easy to have a bit of a knee-jerk reaction. The other problem as well is if you've been breached, the chances are you're already vulnerable to a secondary breach, and there have been situations where, you know, other threat actors have come around and capitalized on the weakness and they've gone at them again.
That's something that always struck me as a journalist. Why aren't there more breaches? Or are there and we just don't hear about them? Are most people breached most of the time? Is that that's what we're saying here?
It's a difficult one to unpick without.
Clearly we're not saying that. Everybody's laughing, by the way, just for the sake.
You probably know the answer to that question.
Yeah, I think I do. Yeah, it's a rhetorical question, but I think I'll tell you what did change as well. While I was writing about breaches, was that you almost instantly knew once you talked to the PR people at an organization that had been breached, and there was some public information out there about it as to how bad it was. Because if they, I remember with one large supermarket chain in the UK, we rang them up and because we knew something had gone on, and they told us everything we needed to know, which completely killed the story, unfortunately. And there are others who are flailing around and just don't have any information. And you think, you just rub your hands in glee, right? Okay, this one's got legs, as we say. Rather cruel as a journalist to do that. But yeah, you certainly see that. But I think with the British Library, like you say, Esther, they were very transparent. They did all the right things. They've communicated well. And yeah, it just struck me as it's a good guide to how to handle some of these things, that you know, you can do all those right things and still get caught out.
What stood out to me in terms of response, Mark, was there is a section in a report that talks about ransom payments, and then it says the library has not made any payment to criminal actors responsible for the attack, nor engaged them in any way, reflecting that that's the UK's national policy for publicly funded institutions. And I did completely get the not paying. That's a discussion we often have amongst our members as well. But I thought the not engaging with them in any way is quite interesting. There is, of course, this... because they went into double extortion. So wouldn't there have been anything that they would have wanted to do to try and get them to recover any data or avoid data publication on the dark web? It's very nice in principle to say that you're not going to negotiate with criminals, but you also have a public duty to protect citizens' data, which they might have been able to do better upon negotiation. I was just wondering how you feel about that.
Yeah, I think it struck me that they clearly didn't seem to have any cyber insurance either. So I guess they didn't have that route to go down to sort of start that negotiation. But yeah, it was a pretty principled stand. And yeah, I think I respect that. But I wonder if it made it harder in the long run. that they, if there had been some negotiation, they could have limited some of that data.
The challenge you have here is government policy is government policy. So the UK government has a long-standing policy on CT. The government will not negotiate with terrorists. I think a similar stance, moves into some point into the cyber world, where the government stance is very clear. They will not negotiate. They will not discuss. I think they were probably just following a very, very clear line issued by His Majesty's government. Oh, Freudian slip. Sorry, Charles. when you move into the private sector, you do have a little bit of license here. Now, in the US, very, very clear in terms of you don't pay ransoms or dues to anyone on the government sanctions list, and variations of that exist elsewhere around the world. It's down to individual organizations to make the decision to engage, to pay or not to pay. And depending on the characteristics of the incident, the prominence of the organization, the vertical that you're in, your regulatory influences, yada, 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 there are lots of things you have to juggle to decide if you are or are not going to engage or pay.
You have to look at the United States. You look at Colonial Pipelines. They did negotiate. They did have conversations. Don't get me wrong, the US government was sat behind them waiting to get all of the ransom back, but they were there, and they were, with the support of the government, negotiating with the group responsible there. If I were to take the British Library example, throughout that report, there's several mentions of DCMS as Department for Culture, Media and Sport. They are the sponsor body for the British Library. They're a direct line into the government. I suspect there was a government minister somewhere who said, you do not talk to them. Yeah. End of conversation.
Yeah.
And that's it. And to Paul's point, private institutions, you have a little bit more wiggle room. I wouldn't argue much wiggle room is really what needed or wanted. Yeah. But there is a little bit there. To Esther's point, there are sometimes bigger forces at play than just we do not negotiate.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, and I think some of those, like you say, those regulations, those guidelines, those, I don't think it's quite laws yet, but are malleable depending on the size of who's been hit. And I think there are some situations where the government would say, you're not going to pay, and the organisation turns around and goes, yeah, we are.
just coming back to your earlier point, Mark, and we should probably talk about this a little bit. I'm sure Esther has as well, being in the middle of the conversations about this. It's, what do we say privately into our organisations? Because we've got to remember our employees are just as vulnerable in an attack. They want to know what's going on. This is their livelihoods as well. And what do you say publicly? And there's a real balance in terms of how much or how little you say, and when you do and you don't say it. And it is an absolute juggling act, especially if it's something that is in the public interest, he said, with the quotation fingers in the air, where we have, the mainstream media getting involved as well. It's a difficult balance to act between that transparency and openness. Again, in the private sector, if you're a PLC, you've got to think about share price volatility. I want to speak to the investors. Equally, you've got to think about reputational damage. You want to keep the customers on side. You want to be transparent. You want to keep that managed as well. That's an absolute juggling act. I mean, how do we feel about the outward facing engagement and communications in context of this incident? And does anyone have any different views on that?
Yeah, well, it does mention staff morale, and just thinking about the British Library as an institution and sort of history. And I would imagine there's a lot of people there that have been there quite a long time and have an enormous commitment to that organisation. And I think to your point, Esther, as well, just a sort of the effect on them and how they do their job could have been devastating. So I think that's definitely something that had to be considered, is just because as well they're going to have to change their culture, their process, just the way they do everything almost to cope with this. So yeah, I don't know, Esther, have you seen that in organizations, that they come out of this changed, I guess, for the better in some respects, but there's you can't come through this without accepting a great deal of change, I suppose.
No, I agree. I think, and that goes for both breaches as well as doing things as red teaming testing. You don't red team test too often because it can be quite destructive for the morale of your team if things doesn't, if there are quite some findings. But same with the incidents. It always provides an incentive often in organizations to do additional investments, get more staff, and that can be a real support The security team then can sometimes feel more seen and appreciated and well-funded. So there's that side to it. But of course, a breach happening in the first place can be very destructive in terms of morale and people feeling they've let the organization down, they've let their clients down, and living with that, especially if you've been in a place for 20 years and you feel you've given your life to that institution.
Yeah, you feel like you've done everything right. Yeah, that's really true. So any closing thoughts sort of on that as a breach? I mean, it sounds like they did a lot of the right things, and I suppose that's the problem with a lot of information security. You do the right things, and occasionally you still do get caught out because the bad guys, they're well-funded, they're innovative, they're very well-motivated. So, yeah, I don't know, Paul, closing thoughts on it? Is it, it's a good test case, and it's there's a lot that can be learned from it, not just for the British Library, but more generally as well?
I think they did a lot very well. They wore their heart on their sleeve in terms of talking openly about what they did and did not do, events leading up and events leading after. There's a line in the report, in the lessons learned, actually, which kind of sticks with me, that, you know, they've survived this experience and they will be the stronger for it. And it says that changes in technology, policy and culture are necessary to secure the library for the future. So now they're thinking about this in the context of the library's strategic ambitions. No doubt it will be more digital than it was today. They now recognize the opportunity risk versus the impact of threat actors that can and will attack at every point and every time. But they recognize, and something I think Esther said earlier, that investment in people and process and technology are required to make the library resilient. They picked themselves up, they dusted themselves down, and they will carry on with that ringing in their ears. And again, as I said at the top, you know, this is never a pleasant experience, regardless of the fact that this is what we're trained for. Every sympathy for the people who ran alongside this and tried to protect an institution that is very loved.
I hope they're getting the help that they need, because I know you've said, Paul, that often it's the immediate aftermath of when you think you've kind of got your handle on it and you're a few months into that process and you're dealing with things and things are changing. It's at that point you can suddenly feel, God, this is really draining, and you know that the impact on morale is felt. But Alex, any closing thoughts? Just, is it a good example? I guess you read other breach reports, or did it?
No, I don't read any of these ever.
right, Alex?
Bedtime reading, that's it.
Don't tell my other half, she won't like it. Blimey, how would I summarise this? British Library, I mean, particularly for listeners who aren't British, it's a bit of an institution here. I mean, the best way I can summarise it, I spent a long time in the British Library when I was doing my master's thesis for my information security degree, as it turns out. I spent a lot of time in their reading rooms, and it's a great institution. It's fantastic. And I mean, pulling it all the way back to, I think it was Esther's comment right at the beginning, you know, why do people target? I think it was opportunistic more than anything else. I think they have been very open. You can tell they've got a lot of people who know how to write at the British Library, because this report is probably one of the best that I've ever written. I think Esther said it earlier. It's factual, it is to the point. The only thing that I sort of stop and get a little concerned for the British Library on is, I was looking at this when we were sort of considering what we were going to be talking about, and I think it was Forbes was reporting that they are expending 40% of their contingency funds on this IT transformation program they're now undertaking in the next 2 years. That is a huge sum of money, especially for an institution like the British Library, which is non-commercial. Whilst all of the work that they are going to do is fantastic, there was a reason it was staggered out over almost 10 years. Their original plan was to go to 2030. So this will result in a more digital British Library. I think it will be a better British Library for what comes at the end of it, but it's not without compromise, and it's not without impacts on staff morale. And yeah, this is good comes out, but it's not been a fantastic experience for them, and I think they appreciate that. There are lots of comments here. They talk about staff, they talk about the impact it has on their goals. That's really important, and I like the transparency with which they're handling this. Is really important.
Yeah, good stuff. Esther, any final thoughts? Well, you've given us a good summary already, but yeah.
Yes, I was reflecting on that the nature of the British Library. This attack has left part of their estate destructed and unable to restore. And it makes you wonder whether some of that knowledge is lost forever, considering they were part of some pretty special digitization projects. And that makes you reflect on maybe even though this institution is not officially part of critical vital infrastructure, maybe it secretly is. Do we want to allow for that kind of knowledge to be lost in attacks like this? I did some search online. I don't live in the UK, so maybe you've seen something else, but I have not seen a public response from the UK government on this particular breach. And it just left me wondering, like, are we really okay with these kinds of attacks taking place? Should institutions like this have more funding to defend themselves? Do we think this knowledge being lost and this impact to researchers not being able to do their work is acceptable to the UK as a nation?
Yeah, I think, no, it's a good point. Yeah, about the priorities and sort of, because I think they were clearly doing the best with what they had. But it was, yeah, they were not unlucky. I guess we don't want to say that, but just, yeah, they did the right things and still unfortunately got caught out. But thanks to Alex, thanks to Paul, thanks to Esther. I would recommend reading that breach report. We'll put a link episode notes for this. They've not quite written the book on good response, but it's pretty damn fine. And I guess we just have to hope there's not going to be a sequel that is even more tragic. But yeah, thank you for listening. You can now find ISF podcasts on all major podcast platforms, Spotify, Apple. We're on everything, even YouTube. And look for our page on Audioboom where you can subscribe to any of those services so you don't miss an episode. The podcasts are also available at securityforum.org, where you can also learn much more about ISF research tools and guidance.